Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree.
I love
it's wrong.
You crazy.
It's the wrong commercial.
Isn't
but
that what I'm supposed to do?
Crazy?
Am I supposed to drive her crazy? I thought that was my
so
job.
That's for Thursday. Okay. That's Thursday.
Oh, that's
show.
For Thursday. So why am I on Tuesdays? If I'm supposed to drive her crazy, I should be on Thursday. I don't understand. Explain it to me. Third base.
Well, you're good at both sides, on Tuesdays and on Thursdays, I'm sure.
Is that what it is? What do you do, play back
Absolutely.
Our show? And she goes, ah! Take it away. Stop, please. Okay, I'll do whatever you want. Okay. Okay. I was searching for something to laugh about at the beginning of the show. I found it. Good morning, everybody.
It provided
we're having a good time. I don't know about you. What were you going to say, Brendan? I'm sorry.
No, nothing. Go ahead.
No, you were talking. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say that the thing to laugh about presented itself, and you took it. You took it and ran. Good, good, good.
Opportunity knocks. You better walk in.
Yeah.
That's right. So, kind of deal. We're having a very good time. I don't know about the rest of you, but we're having a very good time here. My name is Jeffrey Swartz. I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Berry. We are both professors of law at the WMU Cooley, I almost said it wrong, WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. And I am supposed to now say that what Brendan and I say are our opinions and our opinions alone. And they are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty, either individually or at large. And good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing
Mr.
fine.
Bionic, my bionic friend.
Oh, you know what? I got to tell you something. I just feel like my vertical leap went from 0 to 2 inches overnight. It was just great. That's how great these things are. By the way, the other voice all of you know is Hezzy's voice. Hi, Hezzy. How you doing?
How are you guys? Always a pleasure.
Okay. Just want to say hello. You're always here. So be that as it may. Okay. You know, I was trying to think of something funny to start the show with, and it just right there, right in front of me. Sometimes you just never know what's going to happen, and I like it that way. We start out each of our shows with Brendan and I having a segment that we call What Do You Really Think? And unfortunately, it is hard to ignore, for me at least right now, a subject that I've talked about numerous times. And that is the first dictator in the history of the United States. That would be the governor of the unfortunate state of Florida, Moron DeSantis. I say all those things because I mean them. All you had to do was pencil in a mustache on this guy, and he'd look like, you know, the ultimate fascist. I call him moron, but that's not really fair. Because either he's got really brilliant people behind him who see him as the next president of the United States and practicing what they're going to do to this country by doing it to the state of Florida. And this state has been run by Republicans now unceasingly for the last 25 years. The last Democratic governor that we had was Lawton Childs, and that was the governor before Governor Bush the first. I got to tell you that this has become such a single party state. I don't care about the national elections. I understand for national purposes, y'all say we're purple. You know, Bush won by 343 votes. Okay. The truth of the matter is that the state of Florida, as it governs itself, is a one-party state. It has been that way for decades. And the Republican Party has become more sycophantic year by year. And as I talked about last week, the legislature of the state of Florida, which is overwhelmingly Republican, being a Democrat in either house, all you do is sit there and collect a paycheck. There is literally nothing you can accomplish except for to bitch and moan every once in a while. But there's nothing you can do, literally nothing you can do. They don't talk to you. They don't advise you. They don't include you on anything. There is nothing you can do. That's the control Republicans have had over this state for all of these years. Oh, yeah, we elected Nikki Fried, the Secretary of Agriculture, which is in charge of gasoline pumps. But that's it. And now this governor, this fascist, this would-be tin-horned dictator, has taken it to a new level. Forget that he openly and brazenly says no to two congressional maps because it doesn't wipe out two overwhelmingly African-American districts. He brazenly says, I want those districts done. It's unfair that African-Americans have their own districts. Forgetting that. And he doesn't even hide his disdain. He doesn't hide his racism in any way, shape, or form. He does everything and everything, anything he can do to keep African Americans from voting, including those who by a constitutional amendment were given the right to vote in the state of Florida. That is, people who have done their time and are out of prison, having their civil rights restored. No, you got to pay off all your costs and all of your fines first. People who just got out of prison can't find a job, can't work, can't support themselves, are living under bridges, can't vote because they didn't pay their fines. And when Bloomberg threatened to pay them all, he said he was going to sue Bloomberg for doing that, interfering in the laws of the state of Florida. He does not hide his racism. And now he has decided that he is going to continue fighting the culture wars. I want someone to explain to me, like I am the fifth grader that they are. Talk to me like you talk to your people. Talk in those simple, guttural, 2,000 vocabulary word way. A math book teaches critical race theory. How does a math book teach Common Core? The fact that math is Common Core? How a math book teaches tolerance for gay rights? I want to hear somebody explain this to me, like I'm Ricky and they're Lucy. Explain it to me, Lucy. And yet he rejects 60% of the math books that are used in the state of Florida because he says that's what they push, the liberal agenda, the woke agenda. This is fascism at its greatest. To take people that cannot help themselves and pick on them even more. To find a boogeyman. This is the boogeyman. This is a man who kept pushing during COVID. You can't tell our people that run businesses how to run their businesses. But what did he do? He told businesses how to run their business, who they could and could not, who they had to do business with. He is invading every single facet. People of the state of Florida recognize it. Every single facet of your lives is going to be controlled by DePiro. Ron DeSantis. And if you are stupid enough, America, to elect this man president of the United States because he is running in 24, don't kid yourself. He is running in 2024. If you are stupid enough, and you are, to elect this man president of the United States, pack your bags, ship your money overseas, and leave this place to who he wants it to be for, white America. I am going to restore America to the white Christian country that it was founded upon. Now, that's his version. The version of the founders is that it is not a Christian country. It may have been very white, and he wants to drive anybody who isn't out of this country. He's going to run on the give us back our country theory. He's not going to hide it. He's going to stand up there and say, America, take your country back. White Americans, take your country back. This is a man who believes himself to be and his destiny to be to restore America to the white America that he wants it to be. If you thought Donald Trump was bad, you got no idea what's coming. This guy is practicing. Trump didn't practice. This guy's practicing on what to do to America. He is as dangerous a person walking the face of the earth as anybody else. And if you want to see somebody love Putin, trust me, Ron DeSantis will love Putin. If you notice, he says nothing about the Ukrainian war. Nothing. But he wants to be president of the United States. America, your day is coming. This guy has to be stopped. Now, people are going to say, yes, you are friends with Charlie Crist, who's running against him, and they're absolutely right. I am friends with Charlie Crist. But I'm not saying these things because of Charlie Crist. I'm saying these things because everything this man is doing is designed to practice what he will do if he becomes president. And if it's a Republican Congress, they will be expected to bow to his every wish. If I send you a bill, you will pass it. If I tell you I don't want a bill, you will not pass it. And that will be his attitude. Wake up. Florida, wake up. You have no idea what's happening to you. Every day, in every way, you are losing one right or another. It has to stop. That's what I really think.
Yeah, that's I tell you, I don't know where we're headed. It's there's so much. Every time you turn around, you know, yeah, they're coming for your math books now. The party of small government, right? Isn't that isn't that amazing? They could say with a straight face, we're the party of limited government, right? And they're coming for your math books. They want to decide what you do with your body. They want to decide for you who you're allowed to have an adult relationship with. They want to decide for you what kind of relationship that can be. They want to decide for you which books you can check out of a library. People need to stop talking about the party of limited government. I've always thought that. I don't know how you can have the social agenda that these people have and advocate for a limited government. What they really want is a limited federal government whenever the federal government is in control of the other party. Because Republicans are very good, as you've sort of just walked through, as bad as they are at winning the popular vote in national elections, they've lost 7 of the last 8. They are superb at controlling local and state government. They know, they have figured this out, the formula, through gerrymandering, through taking over the judiciary, of taking control of states and really pretty much the country at this point.
Right.
Without having a majority.
Learned it through the Koch brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is how they learned it, the Koch brothers, who were who together, but with the one that's left, I think Charles is the one that's left, okay, did it basically because they were authoritarians too.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they did it.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
America's got to wake up. People in the state of Florida have to wake up.
Yeah.
People in the state of Florida have the ability to stop Ron DeSantis. All they got to do is throw him out as governor. And I'm not pushing this because I want Charlie Crist to be governor. There were years ago that Charlie Crist was the governor. He was a friend of mine. When I was off the bench, there were some attempts to put me back on the bench. He tried to help, but that was as much as he could do. There were too many roadblocks. Okay? But the fact of the matter is that Charlie, a former Republican, is considered to be a fairly neutral, middle-of-the-road Democrat, and that's fine. Okay? But it doesn't matter who's running against him because this guy is more dangerous. Because remember, the House and the Senate of the state of Florida are going to remain Republican until I'm dead. And that hopefully is a long time from now because of the way they gerrymandered their districts and the way that we're pocketed the way we are. North Florida, South Florida, Central Florida, Southeast Coast, the Atlantic Coast. I mean, but they're going to be like this. It's going to be like this. And there's nothing really we can do about the legislature. But we can do something in statewide elections to limit what they can accomplish. Right now, even a Democrat who gets elected governor will be over his veto or her veto would be overridden every time anyway because they got the numbers. But at least somebody who controls the mechanisms of the state of Florida and the departments of the state of Florida. I mean, do you know they just finished a special session and they didn't do what Ron wanted them to do? So he's called two more special sessions. These legislators do more damage in 2 months than Congress does working full-time. I cannot imagine if they were a full-time legislature, just how bad things could be down here. But he's got them coming back, and he's not going to leave them alone until they give him what he wants. So this is very bad stuff.
Yeah,
it really is.
Yeah,
the joy of my life right now would be to debate Ron DeSantis on the value of fascism and whether he really is a fascist. The people's representatives wanted one thing; he didn't care. I want what I want, like a petulant child stomping his foot on the heads of legislators. America.
Yeah, and that on a related note, when it comes to what I was thinking this morning, and we were talking about earlier, Joe Biden's poll numbers have cratered, and I think that says an awful lot about the American people, and it doesn't say anything good. You look at the situation that the country is in, booming economy except for inflation. The world could have blown up in a conflagration. He's managed quite well to avoid that while at the same time putting Ukraine in the position to win a war against Russia. I heard a general, by the way, say, we've been told that Russia had the second best army in the world. It turns out they only have the second best army in Ukraine.
That's very good. They were the third best army in Ukraine because the Russian separatists had a better army than they did. Go ahead.
Right. But you know, and you and I, Jeff, were talking before we came on about inflation, and so we get it. And I come back to this repeatedly on this show, but the you're paying too much for, and I think the same thing, right? I go to the store, I say a steak shouldn't cost that much, a gallon of gas shouldn't cost that much. Some of my favorite seafood, you know, they're out of it. You know, I can't get cod from my local Publix, right? So these things irritate me. Okay, but here's a news flash. None of that is Joe Biden's fault. There's nothing he could do about it. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. Inflation. Okay, what's caused inflation? What's caused inflation were disruptions in the supply chain, right? Econ 101, prices are a product of supply and demand. If you interrupt supply, you're going to affect prices. Now, why did we have interruptions in the supply chain in the U.S. economy? Okay. One short word, COVID. COVID is the reason that we had disruptions in the supply chain. Why did COVID get so bad that it actually disrupted the supply chain in the United States? Because people were sick. Why? Because Americans can't get their act together and take this seriously and get vaccinated so we can get it over with. That's why. How much of what I just said is Joe Biden's fault? Or is he the guy trying to get it right? What do you want him to do? You want him to end COVID? The same people who complain that he hasn't ended COVID yet won't get vaccinated, won't wear masks. Then we got a Trump judge saying he can't impose a mask mandate even for air travel. What is he supposed to do? You say you disapprove of the job Joe Biden is doing. Why? And if you can't answer that question intelligently, then there's something wrong with you, and it's called ignorance. What would you have him do in Ukraine that he hasn't done? You want the old guy back? Embarrassing, humiliating the United States every minute of every day with every tweet? You can have him. People need to start paying attention. Read something. Think something through. That's what I think.
You know, I think that they blame the issue on messaging. I listen to these pros on TV say that Biden's problem is messaging. He doesn't have a singular message to sell people. There's so much going on that he can't. He tries to set out a singular message and another crisis comes along and he has to talk about that instead of the message he's trying to say. He has tried to tell the American people over and over again that the American economy is just roaring. And it is. And that's one of the reasons why we have inflation. You have an increasing amount of demand because of all the people that are now working and making more money than they did before, versus a stagnant, if not decreasing, supply. Well, what happens? If I've got a product that everybody wants, am I going to sit back and just take a dollar for it? Or am I going to hold out for the best I can get? I want $5 for my product. Because if you don't want to buy it at $5, I'll sell it to somebody else at $5. That's what's called a seller's market. And that's one of the problems. The other is we literally, and this sound, I know this sounds like, you know, talking out of both sides of my mouth, But the truth of the matter is that we have to get control over oil companies. I want you to think about this for a second. I want everybody to think about this. Every time the price of oil goes up on Thursday, on Friday you pay more for gasoline. Did that gasoline get done from the pump, pumping the oil to the pump that you're pumping from in one day? It takes months for that oil to find its way here, to be refined into gasoline, and then to your pump. So the gas that you're pumping now was made at a cheaper oil price than what yesterday they decided they would raise it to. Why are you paying more profits on something that's already been made in anticipation of the price going up? When the price goes up and that product reaches the market, you raise the price. But oil companies continue to gouge based upon the price of oil that they're paying today, not what they paid for the product they're selling you now. And when the price goes down, if the price of oil craters, do they lower the price of gasoline immediately? No, they know they have to lower it, so a penny here, a penny there. Well, we paid so much for that oil, so we have to get our profits out of that oil. Okay, so in other words, now I don't get the reduction because you paid more for the oil, but I don't get the benefit, I get the increase even though you paid less for the oil. Please explain this to me. Again, like I'm a fifth grader. So if you want to blame people, don't blame the guy who can't control that, doesn't have the authority to control it, can't tell people you can't sell your oil for more than a certain amount of profit. Remember, we're a capitalistic free society. If that's what you want, that's what you're going to get. The people with the money are going to charge you more, and they don't care if you're poor. And forget the fact that they don't make that much money off of the gasoline unless they gouge it out of you. They make that money selling you coffee and candy and donuts, run the pump slow so you got nothing better to do so you go inside and buy food. That's where I want to feed myself, at a gas station. I mean, it's crazy to blame Biden because you're paying more for gasoline right now. The gasoline you're pumping at $5 a gallon is the same gasoline and the same oil that you were paying $3 a gallon for. They've already worked in they're just gouging. And America doesn't understand that as long as you allow oil companies to control your transportation, they're going to gouge because they're working on a product which has a finite end. Sooner or later, we're going to run out of oil, and they know it. They know it. So if you've got a product and you know, oh, I only got so much and there's no place else to find this stuff, I better get my money now. That's what they're going to do to you. But you don't want electric cars. You don't want to invest in something that you can tell the oil, stick your middle finger up at the oil company. I just need enough gasoline to run my car, the car that I have, that antique I have. Every once in a while, I want to go out and run the car. And the fact that my skies will be clearer, my air will be better, more breathable, means nothing to me. This is the way Americans think. You have no imaginations, America, none. You're incapable of three-dimensional thinking. And Ron DeSantis wants, and I'm coming back to him, wants to make you not even a single-dimension thinker. All you do is what the Defuhrer tells you to do. That's just terrible. Okay. Yeah, I got off my meds. I got off my meds, and I'm just like wired right now. Okay. Okay. Oh, you know, I know what we talked about. Let's talk about our favorite ex-president. You want to talk about him?
Sure.
We were talking just before the show started, and I want everybody to chip in on this one. We all know who Lisa Murkowski is, right? Senator from the state of Alaska, who, by the way, the last time she was elected, she got defeated in the primary, in the Republican primary. She ran
right.
as an independent, and she clobbered both of them. She got more than 50% of the vote as an independent, okay?
And as a write-in,
you know,
as a write-in.
As a write-in, as a write-in,
yeah.
okay? As a write-in.
Yeah.
Who the hell wins when you're a write-in, okay? Okay? So she comes in, and of course she voted in favor of the impeachment and, you know, all kinds of things that, you know, set that golden hair on fire, what's left of it. And so she's a target. And she drew another Republican opposition in her primary who was in, I won't even say her name because, it's, you know, she's a moron. But besides, she's backed by the guy with the golden hair. It's not actually gold. It's actually dyed that color, but that's beside the point. Because there's nothing real about him anyway. And that person has raised like less than $1 million for a statewide campaign in Alaska. You can spend $1 million in a week on transportation campaigning in Alaska. And Murkowski had raised over $5 million at this point. What this has become a proxy war between Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump. Donald Trump has endorsed the opposition, and Mitch McConnell has basically called his bluff. This is like, okay, here's the minimum bet. Here's $5. Okay, Mitch McConnell has said, I'm all in. Okay, whatever chips you got. I'm all in. And Donald's got $115 million that he's raised, but he spends none of it. He did spend $500,000 on the opposition to Brian Kemp, but let's forget that for now. And Mitch McConnell has said that his Senate Leadership Fund, which is a PAC, which is aligned with him, spent $7 million buying ad time for Lisa Murkowski. So Lisa Murkowski now has $12.2 million to her opponent's less than $1 million. And the only person that can save her opponent is Donald Trump. And he's basically saying, put up or shut up. It's a proxy war. It's interesting as hell to see what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mitch wants to keep this seat. And he knows that if Murkowski loses, the question of whether she'll run as a write-in again, okay, where real Republicans will vote for her, the question will be what will happen. Could a Democrat actually take that seat? Sarah Palin, by the way, as I understand it, has endorsed Murkowski's opponent.
Shocking.
Oh, yeah, she's back. She's back. We didn't talk about that. Sarah's back. Okay, the hockey mom is back. I'd like to turn her into a hockey puck. But, I mean, okay. She's back. Okay, she's like a bad penny. She keeps turning up. She must be broke and needs the job. I don't know. Third base. Okay. She's running for Congress along with 50 other people for one seat.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's running on name recognition. Okay. Everybody knows the devil's name, right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to vote for her? I don't know. I don't know. So, By the way, Trump has sent a $5,000 check to Murkowski's opponent.
$5,000.
$5,000. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's got $110 million in the bank on his Save America PAC. Save America. from what? Yeah. You? So.
Yeah.
An interesting
speaking
little
of Sarah,
story, I thought.
Yeah. And speaking of Sarah Palin, you know, she fits this trend, this downward spiral, really, that she's part of. When it comes to the anti-intellectualism of the Republican Party, do you remember thinking it can't get worse than Dan Quayle? Remember Dan Quayle?
Couldn't spell potato. Could not spell potato.
Right.
Okay.
No, just a dull-witted, you know, and you think that's just embarrassing that that's the vice president of the United States.
Is there
States.
Really so, an E at the end of potato?
No. But here's
okay.
something you never want to say. Here's something you never want to say anymore, that the Republican Party can't go lower, right? Because, okay, after Dan Quayle, we get George W. Bush, who wasn't just vice president. He was president of the United States twice, two terms. And, you know, listening to this guy, right, he can't string a sentence together. Doesn't understand the concept of a subject and a predicate. And he's president of the United States. And you think, oh, well, you know, what did he do? Except, you know, he actually did crash the economy, right? You have to, if you're president,
really
you have to work. You have to work to do that. Left us with two wars that he didn't finish. That he put on credit cards. Right? And so you think, that can't get worse than this. And then along
hey,
comes Sarah Palin.
You know what's worse? Bush can't even lie down on a couch watching a football game without falling off of it.
And choking on a pretzel, right?
There you go. He was choking on a pretzel. There you go.
Yeah, right.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, but then we get – and so you just kind of think, you know, well, we must have hit the bottom here in terms of, you know, we've got an anti-intellectual. And these people are anti-intellectual. They hate books. They hate people who know stuff. They hate scientists. God forbid you have a PhD, you know, they hate you for that. So, you know, we can't go much lower than George W. Bush. I mean, this guy is not, you know, he's not a, not very bright. Then along comes.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Then along comes Sarah Palin. You know, and you think, literally as this is unfolding before me, you know, through my adult life, I keep thinking it can't get worse than this. It cannot get worse than Sarah Palin. Possibly.
You were wrong. You were wrong.
I was wrong. Along comes
the one
Donald
thing I
Trump.
Get out of this is right. You were wrong. Okay.
Yes. Right. Right. Don't ever think there's a bottom to this. It's, so you mentioned Sarah Palin, and it just brought that up. I mean, it just keeps getting worse.
And it comes back to what I've been saying. And how many times do I have to say it? It comes back to the fact that Americans are stupid. They've been raised to be stupid. And I know people, you know, and I know that there are a lot of people who resent what I say about this. And I'm sorry. But America, you're stupid. Okay, I'm not that smart. Nah, I'm a little above average. I'm not that smart. But I'm a hell of a lot smarter than you are. Not you, Brandon, or Hezzy, but I mean America. Okay? I'm smarter than you. Because I was edumacated. And you're not being edumacated. And because you're not, you don't understand the people that talk to you and try to explain things to you. You just want a guy that's going to tell you things are going to be better, and even if he's not making it better, make it sound like it's better in simplistic terms that you don't have the ability to understand that it's W.C. Fields up there telling you there's a sucker born every minute, like P.T. Barnum. Go away, kid, you're bothering me. You don't want the truth because you can't understand it. And you don't want better for your kids. You want them to be dumb like you. What more you want from your life, kid? You got a check, you got a pickup truck, and you got a shotgun. What the hell else do you need out of life? You don't need to be better than me. What's wrong with me? Don't tell me I'm not good enough for you. And that's the way you live your lives. You don't work hard to make your kid's life better than yours. Your attitude is, I got a great life. I got a six-pack in the fridge, and I got a recliner and a big screen TV. What the hell else do I need? And once a year, I'll buy a ticket for a pro football game and dress up like an idiot. This is what you see your life being that you think is so wonderful that your kids should have the same life. You don't want to spend money for their education. You don't want to make their lives better. You don't want to push them to get an education so that their life in the future will be better. And if nothing else, I'll help support you because you don't have a pension and you're going to try to live on Social Security. This is what you want out of life. And that is what makes you stupid. I don't blame you for being stupid. I blame Republicans, especially in the state of Florida, who have just killed public education. But you know what? Fight for your children. But you don't want to. That's why they don't try to do anything about it, because they don't understand and they never frigging will. All they understand is gas at the pump is $5. Got to be somebody's fault. And the president's the first guy I want to point to. I didn't vote for him in the first place. Got to be his fault. See, when Trump was in there, we were only paying $2.50 to $3. So it's got to be his fault. And you don't think you're stupid. Can I insult anybody else today?
Yeah.
You got anybody else in mind that I can insult today? I mean, kind of in the mood. I've been locked up in this house for 2 weeks. And
right.
My idea of getting out is taking Putin. A five-minute walk. Okay, so give me a break. That's why Marilyn went back to St. Petersburg. Being locked up with me for 2 weeks has got to be, you know, like, I don't know. Solitary confinement in a Russian prison for 10 years? Okay. I'm sorry. Today I'm Gilbert Gottfried. I'm going to insult everybody.
Right.
Okay. In honor of Gilbert Gottfried, I am going to insult everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can't help it. I really can't. I just, you know. I look at videos. I listen to videos of him. I got bored, you know, after he died. So I started looking, and I got a disc for Gilbert. And then Marilyn says, I can't stand his voice. Why does he have to talk like that? Okay, Aflac. Okay.
Right.
I say, do you understand what he's doing? She says, no, I don't understand. I said, he's impersonating the sound and the voice of an 80-year-old Jewish elder cocker, old man. Okay, that's what he's trying to sound like. Well, does he have to talk so loud? I said, they all talk that loud. They didn't believe in hearing aids. Okay. Okay, Hesley knows what I'm saying, right, Hesley? Okay.
Yeah, I understood that one.
Okay. They sit on park benches and scream at each other.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, and you've seen it for yourself. Okay, and so I said, that's why they talk so loud. Why does he have to talk so loud? Why is he always screaming? That's why he talks like that. That's like him with the Aflac thing, okay? I just, you know.
It's hereditary.
and cultural, both. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. It's just she just didn't understand. Now she does. But I mean, she says, now I understand why you talk so loud. Get a hearing aid. I just, okay. I will miss that man. Okay. I know that he was offensive in so many different ways. He pushed that envelope so far out of shape that instead of being like a rectangle, it was more like a circle. Okay. But I got to say this. He was just, I laughed at him because he made us laugh at ourselves. He really did. And yes, there were times that his humor was way over the edge. The 9/11 joke was horrible. It really was horrible. Okay? It really was. Today you could tell that joke. It might not be as horrible, but it's still horrible. Okay? I understand that. But with all of the, and that's why other comedians love the guy. Because he said the things that they were afraid to say. And he pushed that edge of that envelope, and nothing was sacred to him. And so, he was funny. I mean, what most people don't remember, I have a CD disc, okay, called Gilbert Gottfried's Dirty Jokes, okay? Okay, every once in a while I play. It is the funniest comedy. It is so offensive in so many different ways. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's hysterical. Okay, and you have to have a sense. If you have any kind of sense of humor, he's going to break through and he's going to make you laugh. Okay, I don't care how offended you get. Okay, you're going to laugh. Okay, and in a way, that's what we need. We literally need to be able to laugh at things like this. Okay, we have to laugh at things that may be offensive, but they're funny. And that's laughing at yourself. If you're offended by it, mostly it's because it's about you. And you have to learn to laugh at yourself. We've lost that ability. We don't laugh at ourselves. We're too busy, as some people say, being politically correct. Okay? They stopped playing Bugs Bunny cartoons because Elmer Fudd was always firing his gun off. Okay, and teaching children that shotguns don't really kill. It's a cartoon, people. And kids know it's a cartoon. So now you get Square Bob Sponge Pants. Okay. I mean, seriously? Okay, my grandson loves Aquanauts. Okay, even a cartoon has to have an educational component. I'm sorry. I thought there was a great educational component in Roadrunner and Coyote. What's his name? Coyote, the Coyote.
Wile E. Coyote.
Okay. Yeah, well, Wile E. Coyote. Okay. That was funny.
I just have to say, Hezzy, that isn't this great? You never when Jeff starts on the tangent, you have no idea where it's going to end up.
Where it's going? Yes.
Exactly.
I don't even know where I'm going.
we've arrived at
road,
square.
And I don't know where I'm going to end up. I'm just afraid it's going to crash.
Yeah, me too.
Oh,
I'm just
God.
Flying coach on this airplane. I'm along for the ride.
Oh, don't get me started on Rocky and Bullwinkle, okay?
Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Okay. Change the subject, Brendan, please. Okay.
Well, but you're right about people needing to laugh. You know, even if it's gallows humor, trying to find humor and tragedy. And for some reason, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about something that's tragic and funny at the same time. And that's a Russian flag, Black Sea flagship, sitting at the bottom of the seabed.
Yeah.
I know it's tragic, but it's also kind of funny. You know, I had it. At least
it's tragic because 500. Yeah. It's tragic because 500 sailors may have died.
Yeah,
we'll never know how many sailors went down with that boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 But the Ukrainians.
But it is funny.
Yeah, I you know, and this it's interesting. You know, when that happened, and I heard, okay, they sunk the ship with Neptune missiles. I got online to try to find out who makes the Neptune missile because I wanted to. I said I'm buying stock in that company, whatever that company is, I'm going to buy stock in it. And it turns out, we didn't give them those. They manufacture Neptune missiles. And
well, they used to. They don't anymore.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but yeah. But
that
was
they blew
else.
Up the factory. I mean, yeah, the Russians
yeah.
blew up the factory.
Right,
okay.
Right. Yeah, which kind of tips their hands, you know, that I think we know how the ship got sunk. But
now they did not lie. No, stop. The Russians did not lie.
Right.
They said the ship sunk because a fire broke out.
Right.
But
they just
didn't
say
how the fire started.
Right.
Yeah. They didn't say who lit the fire. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
They forgot the part that it was sunk as a result of a fire that broke out on board when a couple of missiles hit us. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They left the last part out. Okay. Okay. But so it wasn't a lie. It wasn't the total truth, but it wasn't a lie. Okay. But we don't yeah. we have no idea how many of those sailors died.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the ones that received, they only about 120 or 150 of them actually got medals, and we're not even sure those 120 and 150 were part of the crew. It was just like a file film of sailors getting medals from an admiral. That's sad. And we haven't seen that, by the way, since the war between England and Argentina over the Falklands.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the last time a ship was sunk, you know, in combat with that many people. 400 Argentinians died. So when a ship gets hit by a missile and it goes down, lots of people die. And you're right. It's funny to Ukrainians. And it's funny, ha-ha, and funny, sad that these things had to happen. And by the way, they're not afraid of Ukrainian missiles. They just moved their other ships 100 miles further out into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not afraid of you. We're just going to back off. Okay. We need deeper water. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Third base. But it's just one of those things. Yeah, I agree with you. There are things that we have to learn to laugh at ourselves about. We have to have a sense of humor. Okay? And you know, the problem is we don't have one. Everybody's offended by everything. You know, even poor Chris Rock pissed off Will Smith, right? So on national television, he gets slapped. And he was perfect. And he has been ever since. Okay? And Will Smith is getting everything he deserves. I hope he has enough money to live on because he's poison. No one's going to touch him. I think he's made his last movie unless he pays to make one. And he deserves it. That's a lesson to teach our children. We don't do that. Like the little kids who say, "Mommy, why is the genie dressed up in a tuxedo hitting another man?"
Mm-hmm.
Guess we're not going to see too much of that movie anymore, are we? Oof. What else we got? Oh, yeah, wait a minute. There was something else we were going to talk about. What did I miss?
Mike, Chip Roy, Mike Lee, that's been in the news.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, go. Mm-hmm. Go with it.
Yeah, the widespread. It's just unbelievable, the corruption. we talk about this every week, but it's just so crystal clear. The choice that's before us, the Republican Party does not care about democracy. It's democracy is fine as long as it's working for them. If it's not working for them, then they'll just as soon throw it out, you know, as look at you. So it turns out Mike Lee and Chip Roy, and you have an interesting take on Chip Roy, but Mike Lee in particular, who I guess, you know, I'm hearing that people, a lot of people are saying, you know, I used to hold that guy in high regard. We didn't think he was one of these. But he's texting Mark Meadows, you know, the chief of staff, trying to find ways to overturn this election. It's just, I don't know how it can be that, you know, that not every single American is just so galled that it was so obvious, right, that Joe Biden won that election. He won that election by, what, 7 or 8 million votes, and Republicans didn't care. They were going to throw away American democracy. So I don't know what's going to happen to Mike Lee. I don't know if he's vulnerable in terms of, you know, electorally. But there's some really – and on a related note, I just saw a headline this morning about John Eastman refusing to turn over records. He's, of course, he's fighting. This is the lawyer who hatched this plan to the coup, right, to overturn American democracy. When are these people going to be disbarred? That's the question I have. We take an oath. Every lawyer takes an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution of the United States. I think it's fair to say to law students today, if you're on the Trump train, get out of law school, because you can't take the oath. You're going to be required to take an oath that you can't take.
Because you don't believe in it.
Right.
You're lying the minute you take the oath.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know how these people still have their ticket.
More people need to get their act together.
State bar.
We got federal judges who should be impeached. But that's beside the point. That's the truth. Who lied during the course of their confirmation hearings. Amy Coney Barrett is probably going to be the first one that I would look at. She out and out lied. So did Kavanaugh.
So what's
going to happen?
So what's going to happen to Mike Lee?
Well, Mike Lee has problems. We have to, first of all, let me go to Representative Roy first. Representative Roy may not have the problems that others have. He may have been willing to vote to decertify things if he was provided proof. He would have gone along with it, and he voted to decertify anyway because he knew it didn't make a difference in the end. But in this particular instance, there is a text message that says, if you have proof, give it to me now. I want proof. Give me proof. One, to convince him, and two, to convince others. Proof that it was never provided to him. And that's as far as his efforts went, wrong as it may be. The thought process that he will say is, I wasn't trying to overturn the Constitution. I wanted proof that these things happened, in which case I felt it was my obligation to not overturn the election but correct a wrong. That's what he's going to say. It's a pretty good argument, too. But for Lee, he's done. He has opposition in his primary, but he's going to win that. But what is going to happen is in the general, he's probably going to lose. Utah, I don't know if they're Utahians or Utans, I don't know what they're called, people from Utah, okay, like their Romneys. They like their McMullins. They like people who tell the truth. That's kind of a tenet of the Mormon church, as I remember it. And so a guy like Mike Lee, who in essence has been lying to them, is not their cup of tea. And I know it rhymed, but I didn't mean it to. But that's really the kind of deal that you have here. I think that Lee's in trouble. I think he's going to be even more trouble when Meadows finally flips, and he will flip. This guy can't even vote anymore. Remember, we didn't talk about this one. Mark Meadows can't vote in North Carolina. He's been removed from the voter rolls. Why? Because he was registered to vote in North Carolina in a double wide out in the middle of nowhere that he has never set foot in. His wife registered him to vote out of that double wide. And then in 2021, he went in and registered to vote in the state of Virginia, and that kind of brought it to light, so they started looking at it as to whether he should be off the voter rolls in North Carolina and realized he should have never been on the vote. So when he voted in North Carolina in 2020, he committed voter fraud. Here's a guy who's screaming and yelling voter fraud all over the country. He should know. He did it himself. Republicans do it, so they figure everybody else is. Like the guy from the Villages who voted four times for Trump in four different states.
Well, we're cutting into Hezzy's time here.
Yeah, we are.
But it's
but,
okay.
I mean, I thought
good. I'm good.
I thought the Meadows thing was great. We didn't even talk about that, did we?
No. No, I don't think we'd fit on that.
I thought that was worth commenting on. I mean, mm-hmm. Seriously, Mark Meadows, you are in so much trouble. And you are such a piece of you-know-what. Okay? And Elijah Cummings, your friend Elijah Cummings, is rolling over in his grave that he ever came to your defense on anything. Because he now realizes you're a lying, manipulating sack of, you know, of horse hockey. And you deserve everything bad that happens to you. And some bad things are going to happen to you. I suggest that you fold up like a cheap suit and do whatever it takes to make everybody who's investigating Trump happy. I want to hear what Kushner and Ivanka had to say.
That's
Kushner
intriguing.
Was quoted as saying, yeah, what Kushner was quoted as saying that when he got off the plane from Saudi Arabia on January 6th, he was asked, why did you go to the White House? He said, no. He said, why didn't you go to the White House? He says, because all I was going to do was fight with him.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went home. I want to know what he has to say. Well, you know, I really do. I want to know what Ivanka has to say on those two times she went in and said, Daddy, Daddy, please stop all the bad stuff from happening, Daddy. I'll sit on your lap again if you want me to. I'm sorry, that picture of him holding her. I mean, when she was like 15, sitting on his lap. I mean, seriously. What 15-year-old girl sits on her dad's lap? I mean, give me a break. Daddy! Daddy, I want to manufacture in China. Can you fix it for me?
All right. Let's stop before this gets out.
I'm telling you, you get off the meds and all the stuff you were thinking comes back to you. It's amazing.
Right.
By the way, I'm not talking about those kind of meds, people. I had a hip replacement. I was on pain meds. Okay? Okay, so. All right, Hezzy. I think Brendan's had enough for today. He has to go, you know, clean out his ears and things like that. So,
right.
Well, gentlemen, it's always a pleasure.
And that's all.
The pleasure's
all.
For me, it is.
Yeah. Absolutely, it's good.
For me, it's always a pleasure. Good. I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm having a good time. All right, guys.
All right, Pezzy.
You know,
have a good week.
Have a good rest of your week. Okay,
yeah,
take care.
All the best, guys.
Talk to you soon.
Thank
you
so much.
Bye-bye.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Let's see. We're going to move on to some other issues and other concerns. Bear with me one moment because I wanted to I don't know if I really want to cover stuff on you know, just the news. And I wanted to go over and do something a little bit different today. And I spoke to Mr. Keston yesterday when he was on the show. And what I want to do is I really do want to spend some time reading about values. And this is all written for me, so I'm going to be reading it to you. So bear with me a moment as I look this up, because I need to get the exact website address for it. So bear with me a moment. Sorry, it wasn't prepared. I was so engrossed in what Brendan and Jeff were talking about, and I just didn't think of going there. Bear with me a second here. All right, so it'll take me a couple of more seconds to do this. I guess it's right. Let me just see. I know why I'm having a little bit of difficulty. All right, let me see if we're going to get this done. All right. Okay, at least I think I got to the website at long last. And now I just have to look for something else. All right, too much. Okay, I should be able to find it any moment now. Okay. Should be able to find it here. Let's just see if I can get this done right. Yep, I think I found it. Okay. Done is I've gone to the website address, which is entitled pdhre.org. PDHRE is the People's Movement for Human Rights Learning. It's a site dedicated to human rights learning for social and economic transformation. So, what I want to do is give you some of the concepts behind it, and what I'll try to do is to really end up, in a sense, educating myself as well as hopefully you're finding it an education as well as we look into this whole process. So, I think it needs to be heard because without it, we're not familiar with what are the rights of people, what are the human rights. So let's start here. Okay, so human rights and development worlds have run parallel to each other, each with its own history, its own constituency, with its own strengths, weaknesses, successes, and failures. The more recent advances, such as the greater recognition of not only legal justice, but also economic and social justice, combined with increased work around economic, social, and cultural rights by the human rights community on the one hand, and the recognition of poverty as a human rights issue by the development community on the other, have brought the two seeming parallel worlds closer together. A step in this direction are the rights-based approaches, the RBAs, which can be viewed as an attempt at a conversation between the two worlds of human rights and development. Given the similarities in longer-term human rights and development visions to achieve human dignity for all, and in anticipation of future evolution of human rights and development work, it is possible to envisage these two seemingly parallels coming even closer. with the support of a major international development family based on discussions with the development agencies and the success of the previous linking and learning programs on economic, social, and cultural rights, Dignity International, in its partnership with Hakijami, the Center for Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, will embark on a new learning program on, quote, human rights in development, end quote. This global program will be aimed at experienced development activists from the different world regions working to get either at the grassroots or at the international advocacy levels. The program will be based on the rich development experience of the participants themselves who, in a non-formal and participatory learning framework, will explore together the meaning of human rights in development work and how integration of human rights into development work translates into concrete strategies and development programming at the grassroots and international levels. So part of the background and the context, the great reform movements, human rights and development. The second half of the 20th century saw the emergence of two great reform movements, one in support of global development and the elimination of poverty across the world, the other calling for international protection and promotion of human rights. However, though both traditions shared much in common, the human rights framework and the thinking underlying development policy were never reconciled conceptually. One had a legal foundation being based on the definition and application of international law that is legitimized by public consent, and the other was closely associated with social and economic planning and pragmatic creation of economic activity, significantly also eventually legitimized by public consent. With the passage of time, it has become increasingly necessary to bring the two approaches together closer and to ensure that policy frameworks are consistent and complementary rather than contradictory and competitive. Advances of have brought the development and the human rights worlds closer together. The human rights successes and limitations. Human rights, non-governmental organizations previously focused on only civil and political rights. Great strides have been made by the human rights community on issues related to civil liberties and political freedom. Improvements were also made for legal justice and legal protection of these civil and political rights at the national and international levels, including the recent establishment of an international criminal court. However, there have been severe limitations with human rights work. The previous narrow focus on only civil and political rights and neglect of economic, social, and cultural rights meant that the human rights community opened itself to criticism as effectively ignoring the interests of the large part of humanity who are living in poverty. A critical mass of people who are or who ought to be the legitimate focus of rights work have consistently been excluded from the discourse. The previous neglect of economic, social, and cultural rights have contributed to a process of separation of needs from rights and also undermined the fundamental interdependence and indivisibility principles of all human rights, be they civil, political, or economic, social, and cultural. The human rights are more than civil liberties. They are also the rights to food, housing, education, health care, and to a decent standard of living. When economic, social, and cultural rights are not respected, all human rights suffer. It is no coincidence that people living in extreme poverty are usually excluded from political processes, from access to information, to a fair, the normal benefits of citizenship. Basic needs are also basic rights. Poverty, seen from the human rights lens, is the largest multiple violation of human rights in the world today. Human rights remain beautiful in theory but have had little meaning and relevance in practice to the poorest and marginalized communities. It is also recently that the human rights community, is paying more attention and increasing their work around economic, social, and cultural rights. And this recognition of ESG rights as human rights and increased work around ESG rights have brought the human rights non-governmental organizations closer to the concerns of the development agencies. Development successes and limitations. As for the development non-governmental organizations been closer to the most impoverished and marginalized people in societies than their human rights counterparts have ever been. At the grassroots level, development projects, be they in the form of community schools, dispensaries, clinics, water and sanitation, microcredits, etc., have made direct improvements to the lives of the most impoverished. At the international level, the development non-governmental organizations have also become more vocal and sophisticated in their research, policy, and campaign work around international trade issues and clearly challenging the unbalanced global financial and economic order. Campaign efforts of the development agencies to stop further agreement among World Trade Organization member states on unfair trade rules at the World Trade Organization Ministerial in Cancun is one such example of an international campaign success. Over the years, the development work has evolved from approaches, including those of charity, to service delivery. These approaches have had some strengths and also some weaknesses. At the local and national levels, where discrimination structures are well entrenched, the previous development approaches offer very little to deal with these deep-rooted structures of discrimination. At the same time, in an age of rapid globalization, where the causes of poverty go beyond national boundaries, again, the development world is missing an internationally recognized and accepted framework that can comprehensively tackle the root causes of poverty, including the global processes of impoverishment, which the human rights framework can offer. Moreover, the growing body of international trade rules are presenting clear challenges to the enjoyment of human rights. It will be critical to reestablish the primacy of human rights of the individual and human rights law over rights, quote-unquote, of multinational corporations, largely embedded in the growing body of international trade laws. Human rights and rights-based approaches. Human rights provide a moral, authoritative, and a legal framework to tackle root causes of poverty, the deep-rooted structures of discrimination, the global processes of impoverishment. A human rights framework has the potential to deal with not only legal justice, the primary preoccupation of human rights non-governmental organizations, but also economic, social, and cultural justice, which is central to development work. However, potential is one thing, reality is another. The moral and legal strengths of the human rights exists, but it risks becoming a dead body of international law if it is not actively claimed by those whose basic human rights are denied, and if the human rights framework is not actively used and pushed to its full potential by agencies working with the poor and marginalized communities. It is therefore a welcome move that the development agencies are discovering for themselves the contribution that human rights could bring to development work. Increasing numbers of international agencies, as well as partners from their grassroots, are adopting rights-based approaches to development. They can be seen as a conversation between the development and human rights organization who are trying to speak the same language but are using different words. Development actors argue that rights-based approaches, RBAs, include not only human rights, as enshrined in the various international human rights instruments, but a wider range of rights, such as environmental, humanitarian, and labor rights, whereas human rights actors would argue all of these rights are already contained in the existing international human rights instruments. Indeed, this is a healthy conversation, especially since it brings the two worlds closer together. What is clear is that given the development agency's firm rooting in the poorest communities, and given their focus on issues of human dignity of the poorest, there is an opportunity to make human rights relevant for all and to enrich the contents of human rights. Exactly what are these rights to adequate food, housing, education, and decent standard of living? What would the right to food mean to a hungry and malnourished person? Who should be obliged to provide them? With the direct contributions from the development and the affected communities to the human rights discourse, the actual contents of human rights might finally have some meaning to the poorest. Converging visions. The vision of the development world is to work for a world free from poverty, where people live in dignity and security, and where there is economic, social, and cultural justice. The human rights vision, as enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, states, quote, recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world, end quote. The two great reform movements might have emerged as parallel movements, but the longer-term visions are essentially the same. It will be important to take concrete steps to bring the two seemingly parallel worlds together, to intensify discourse and learning so that the development and policy frameworks are consistent and complementary in achieving the longer-term human rights and human development vision, which in essence is to achieve human dignity. Learning Program on Human Rights and Development. This new global program will take place in the field close to the hearts of many development projects to allow development activists to see, feel, smell, hear, taste, touch for themselves the reality on the ground, and think, share their grassroots and international level experiences, as well as in the context of an informal learning program, find concrete ways to integrate human rights in development programming. The new learning program will build on discussions of partner organizations with the development agencies and on the successes of learning of previous learning programs, including the Global Linking and Learning Program on Social and Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, organized by Dignity International, in partnership with Forum Asia, International Human Rights Internship Program, and the International Network on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, ESCR-net. So here are the program objectives: to provide development organizations from headquarters and field with knowledge and a better understanding of human rights, and in particular economic, social, and cultural rights and their direct relevance and impact on development work. Also, to equip participants with the skills necessary to integrate human rights and the human rights-based approach in development work, and to learn from them what new ideas and methods would be possible for implementation in the field. Further, provide a space for the exchange of experiences and ideas in the actual programming of rights-based approaches and the current implementation of human rights in development work. Further, affect change in international policy and campaign work by paying more attention to international human rights instruments and how these help to strengthen our work to address the global processes of impoverishment. Further, affect change in development strategies to tackle the root causes of poverty through human rights and what this means in the actual program implementation. So there are program assumptions. A human rights framework offers distinctive strengths and specific tools, and it is these that we will explore in a program that is designed to give development managers, planners, and advocates extra capacity in their work and that of their organizations. So let's talk about program contents. The program will take the participants on a learning journey that will begin with the basics on human rights and development, the innate nature of human rights and human development that together arrive at the longer-term vision of human dignity. Participants will explore and analyze why a human rights framework considers, quote, basic needs as basic rights, and how this brings about a fundamental strengthening in the fight against poverty. The program will also explore the, quote, empowerment strategies, end quote, of the development agencies and how a shift in the development model from charity to rights using human rights strengthen the empowerment process of the most vulnerable to the extent of bringing about social change. The program will also cover the human rights obligations of state and non-state actors, including corporations and international financial institutions. And from there, share and build on responses from the development community to challenge the, quote, unfair political, economic, and financial order, end quote, and how this can advance human rights work. At the same time, the participants will explore how human rights provide a comprehensive framework for an international order conducive to the realism of human dignity. Program will cover monitoring and evaluation work and tools used for this and help dispel the mysteries and technicalities around benchmarks and indicators and provide opportunities for participants to practice developing both and with a focus on the Millennium Development Goals as benchmarks for our governments and verify government on some ESG rights from ground reality and our own markers. So these are some of the programs we'll get into in the future so that we get a sense of what's happening. Now, let's move on to some other things that you might find interesting. And so I wanted to cover some other things on the international stage. Most important, chemical weapons are a threat which raises the stakes for Mariupol's last stand. It seems that the Ukrainian city of Mariupol is on the verge of falling to Russian forces after a brutal siege that has lasted more than 40 days. Recent reports of a chemical weapon attack are raising fears in the city, but is the threat real, which is a big question. After more than 40 days spent defending the city of Mariupol, the 36th Marines unit of the Ukrainian Army posted a message to Facebook on Monday. Today will probably be the last fight as the ammo is running out, they wrote. Some of us will die. Some will be captured. I beg you to remember the Marines. In the past 6 weeks, Russian forces have worked to surround and suffocate the port city in southeast Ukraine. Humanitarian corridors have been blocked. Civilians have been attacked. Schools and hospitals have been bombed. Satellite images show a once thriving city largely reduced to rubble. According to Mayor Vadim Boychenko, 90% of the infrastructure of the city has been destroyed and the death toll could surpass 20,000. On April 11, he said, corpses were, quote, carpeted through the streets, end quote. On the same day, a new threat emerged. Ukraine's Azov battalion reported that a Russian drone had dropped a poisonous substance, quote-unquote, on troops and civilians in Mariupol, causing respiratory failure and neurological problems. The threat of chemical weapons is real, Russian military strategy expert Katarzyna Zinsk advised. The civilian population and the government have good reason to be very afraid of that. Avoiding unbearable humiliation. The use of chemical weapons was banned by the international community after World War I, with agreements reinforced in 1972 and 1993 to prohibit their development, stockpile, or transfer. Consequently, Russia's use of chemical weapons in Ukraine would be a war crime, but one it may be willing to commit. Russia is losing this war, and the humiliation is unbearable and unacceptable for the Russian authorities, said Zisk. Chemical weapons would help tactically to win battles, but also pile psychological pressure on the Ukrainian government to stop the resistance and accept Russia's conditions for ending the conflict, end quote. Chemical weapons could also provide a quick end to conflict in the Mariupol. Makes military sense at the moment for Russia to clear Mariupol as quickly as possible, because that would free a lot of forces for their planned offensive in the Donetsk area. Chemical weapons expert and former head of the Organization of the for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW Laboratory, Mark Michael Bloom, advised. A blatant, large-scale chemical attack would risk outraging the international community already hostile to Russia, but a smaller, targeted attack would be much harder to prove, especially in an area inaccessible to the outside world, such as Mariupol. In Mariupol, we have a small pocket of Ukrainian resistance who are cut off, Bloom said. There's no chance that any people affected by a chemical attack will go to hospital where samples can be taken. It's more likely that they will either be captured or killed by the Russians. So there are grounds to believe that Russia can conceal the use of chemical weapons because they can't prove it happened. There's a lack of proof. However, Bloom is skeptical about the chemical attack approved by the Azov Battalion in Mariupol. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was also cautious. He said in an address on Wednesday that it was not possible to draw firm conclusions about whether Russian forces had used chemical weapons in Mariupol, since it was impossible to conduct a proper probe in the besieged city. Proving that a chemical attack has taken place is a long and complicated process, similar to proving other war crimes. On-site samples must be collected and analyzed along with witness accounts, videos, photographs, and any other documentation. Once you have that proof a chemical weapon was used, only then can you go further and say, well, who used it? But attribution is even more difficult, Bloom said. The amount of real, credible information from Mariupol is still very limited. Complicating matters further is the fact that officially Russia has no chemical weapons. It signed in 1993 the Chemical Weapons Convention that came into force in 1997, banning signatories from storing, developing, or using chemical weapons. In September 27 of 2017, OPCW verified the total elimination of Russia's declared chemical weapons stocks. Since then, small-scale chemical attacks have been attributed to Russia due to evidence of the Russian nerve agent Novichok. And these include the 2020 attack on Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny and the 2018 attack on the former Russian military officer and double agent for the British intelligence agencies Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia Skripal. Russian involvement in larger-scale chemical weapons in Syria and Chechnya are widely suspected, but unproven. Quote, we lack any real credible information that Russia still has large stockpiles, meaning tons of chemical warfare agents, Bloom said. Quote, but it is a possibility. But is it a possibility? It's a large country and has a history of trying to cheat on such conventions. Russia maintains that use of chemical weapons in Syria was staged by Western intelligence or carried out by opposition forces, accusations that are difficult to disprove. If Russia were to use chemical weapons in Ukraine, Zisk expects it would make similar claims. A few weeks ago, this narrative from the Russian government came up about biolabs in Ukraine, basically trying to say that if a chemical attack happened, it could be the Ukrainians themselves, she said. And that creates plausible deniability and doubt. even before the war began, a conflicting narrative began to emerge. As early as December 2021, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said that U.S. military contractors were smuggling tanks filled with unidentified chemical components, end quote, into Ukraine as a provocation towards Russia. In March 9 of 2022, the war was underway and the United States was warning that Russia could use chemical weapons in Ukraine but attribute them to Washington as a false flag to justify an invasion. In Mariupol, of course, you can also look at it from the other side, Bloom said. Ukraine is understandably desperate, so is there some interest for the Ukrainians to declare a chemical weapons attack that never happened? The Azov battalion that reported the attack in Mariupol is staunchly anti-Russian. Having originally formed as a paramilitary militia with pro-Nazi leanings to fight the Russian invasion in Donbass in 2014. Its claim of an attack elicited a swift response from the United Kingdom government. If the claims were found to be true, all options were on the table for what the response could be, said British Armed Forces Minister James Heapy. Zelensky, too, seized momentum on Wednesday to urge Western leaders to act now to prevent a future chemical attack from Russia happening. The U.S. has been more measured. While Biden on Wednesday accused Russian President Vladimir Putin of genocide, quote-unquote, in Ukraine, the White House has said claims of chemical weapons use remain unverified, although it is concerned that Putin may take such a step. This could be the fate of other cities as well. For 6 weeks, news from Mariupol has been dominated by stories of pure destruction. Ukraine has accused Russia of engineering a humanitarian crisis in the city by blocking corridors that would allow essential supplies and medical aid in or citizens to flee. And those who have managed to escape have described scenes worse than a horror film. Whether or not chemical weapons have or will be used, the threat of an attack has been hanging in the air for months, ramping up fears in an already desperate situation. There is strong psychological element, Zisk said. The threat of chemical weapons is very scary. Creating fear of the chemical attack, even without the attack itself, could be one last way Russian forces are attempting to break morale in Mariupol and in Ukraine. On the other hand, carrying out an attack would be a way for Russian forces to spread even more fear and quickly clear the city. In the process, they would gain an important victory for Putin and a strategic foothold blocking Ukrainian access to the Sea of Azov. Either option seems beneficial to Russia. The only certainty looks to be that Mariupol will soon fall, and the excessive destruction of the city sends a clear message. Quote, Mariupol is a warning to the Ukrainian authorities, end quote, said Zisk. Quote, it's saying, look at what we are doing here. This could also be the fate of other cities, end quote. I think it's time for us just to look and see if there's anything else we can cover with you in the last moments. 1 second. Well, this is very interesting as well. Israel has intercepted rocket fired from Gaza as tensions evidently soar. Palestinian militants fired a rocket into southern Israel for the first time in months on Monday in a potentially major escalation after clashes at a sensitive holy site in Jerusalem and a wave of attacks and military raids elsewhere. Israel said it intercepted the rocket and there was no immediate reports of casualties or damage. Israel holds Gaza's militant Hamas rulers responsible for all such projectiles and usually launches airstrikes in their wake. It was the first such rocket fire since New Year's Eve. So hours earlier, the leader of the Islamic Jihad militant group, which boasts an arsenal of rockets, had issued a brief cryptic warning condemning Israeli, quote, violations, end quote, in Jerusalem. Ziad al-Nahala, who is based outside the Palestinian territories, has said threats to tighten an Israeli-Egyptian blockade on Gaza imposed after Hamas took power in 2007, quote, can't silence us from what's happening in Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank, end quote. Palestinians and Israeli police clashed over the weekend in and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem, which has long been an epicenter of Israeli-Palestinian violence. It is the third holiest site in Islam and the holiest for Jews, who refer to it as the Temple Mount because the mosque stands on a hilltop where the Jewish temples were located in antiquity. Protests and clashes were last year eventually led to an 11-day Gaza war. Police said that they were responding to Palestinian stone throwing and that they were committed to ensuring that Jews, Christians, and Muslims, whose major holidays are converging this year, could celebrate them safely. Palestinians view the presence of police at the site as a provocation. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said on Monday that ahead of the rocket fire that Israel has been the target of a Hamas-led incitement campaign. The latest tensions come during the confluence of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan and the week-long Jewish holiday of Passover. Christians are also celebrating their holy week leading up to Easter, and tens of thousands of visitors have flocked to Jerusalem's Old City, home to major holy sites for all three faiths for the first time since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. This convergence happens every 33 years. Jordan and Egypt, which made peace with Israel decades ago and coordinate it with it on security issues, have condemned its actions at the mosque. Jordan, which serves as custodian of the site, summoned Israel's Shah's affair on Monday in protest. Jordan's King Abdullah II discussed the violence with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, agreeing on, quote, the need to stop all illegal and provocative Israeli measures, end quote, there. According to a statement, Jordan planned to convene a meeting of other Arab states on the issue. Israel has been working to improve relations with Jordan over the past year and has recently normalized relations with other Arab states over their shared concerns about Iran. But the Jerusalem clashes and a recent wave of violence have brought renewed attention to the conflict with the Palestinians, which Israel has sought to sideline in recent years. An Arab party that made history last year by joining Israel's governing coalition suspended its participation on Sunday, a largely symbolic act that nevertheless reflected the sensitivity of the holy site, which is at the emotional heart of the century-old conflict. Israel captured the West Bank, along with the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem, which includes the Old City in the 1967 Mideast War. The Palestinians seek those territories for a future independent state. While Palestinians have long feared that Israel plans to take over or partition the mosque compound, and in recent weeks, calls by Jewish extremists to sacrifice animals there have circulated widely among Palestinians on social media, sparking calls to defend the mosque. Israeli authorities say they have no intention of changing the status quo, and police are enforcing a prohibition on animal sacrifices. Israel says its security forces were forced to enter the compound early on Friday after Palestinians stockpiled stones and other objects and hurled rocks in the direction of an adjacent Jewish holy site. The violence in Jerusalem has come in the wake of a series of Palestinian attacks inside Israel that killed 14 people, and Israel has launched near-daily arrest raids and other military operations in the occupied West Bank that it says are aimed at preventing more. The Israeli military said on Monday it arrested 11 Palestinians in operations across the occupied West Bank overnight in a raid in the village of Yamun near the city of Jenin. The army said dozens of Palestinians hurled rocks and explosives at troops. Soldiers responded with live ammunition toward the suspects who hurled explosive devices, the military said. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that two men were hospitalized after being critically wounded, and two of the attackers came from in and around Jenin, which has long been a bastion against Israeli rule. At least 25 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in recent weeks, according to an Associated Press count, and many had carried out attacks or were involved in clashes, but an unarmed woman and a lawyer who appears to have been a bystander were also among those killed. One thing that's really interesting, Islamic law forbids wearing shoes in the mosque, and yet young Palestinians created a scenario in which they came in with rocks, which they threw in the mosque, and they wore shoes, treading the filth outside of the mosque itself. And a lot of people don't recognize that because they don't understand anything with regard to the Islamic law and the tradition, as well as what the tradition demands and what the law demands. And when they see youth, young people throwing stones, wearing sneakers and shoes, walking on carpets that are supposed to be sacrosanct, you know this is all a setup. And it looks like it's like some sort of, some sort of challenge, but it's a desecration. It's an absolute desecration of their own religion. And it's absolutely outrageous. And quite often, most people in the news don't even have a clue what's going on. So anyway, so that's the story. You can look it up and check it out yourself. Take care and be well, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.